Montana's two-year colleges get a big grant to help train skilled workers. Good evening, I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Kendra McQuillan looks into new research on how knapweed affects how birds sing. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the former U.S. ambassador to South Korea about the importance of diplomacy in that region and in the Middle East. The U.S. Department of Labor is giving a nearly $25 million grant to the state's public two-year colleges and tribal colleges. The grant, announced today, will be used for the expansion and development of training programs in the areas of energy and advanced manufacturing. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the Office of the Commissioner of Higher Education expects the four-year grant to serve 10,000 people.
It's, I believe, going to transform two-year education and how two-year and community college education in Montana reacts and responds to workforce training requests.
Deputy Commissioner for Two-Year and Community College Education John Seck says it's the biggest external grant the state has ever received for two-year schools. Montana's almost $25 million will be split up among 13 institutions, 10 two-year and community colleges, and 3 tribal colleges. Governor Steve Bullock says since taking office at the beginning of the year, he has spoken to many CEOs who have expressed an interest in coming to Montana, but they are looking for specific skills in the workforce.
Our job on the government side is to make sure that we can actually get the curriculum together to meet that need.
That is what this grant looks to provide. John Seck with the Commissioner of Higher Education's office and the State Department of Labor and Industry are partnering with almost 60 private industrial employers to implement the grant. Employers in industries like oil, gas, and coal development, healthcare, and transportation, those businesses saying, we need workers that can do this specific job, and then working with the colleges on the curriculum.
Working with us to establish the competencies that they're looking for, and then the program outcomes.
Great Falls College will be coordinating the grant efforts and is receiving the largest chunk of the money, $8 million. Each institution will be focusing on different things. For example, Missoula College will develop hybrid energy technician and welding programs. Helena College will be working on diesel training. Flathead Valley Community College will take the advanced manufacturing work. Then Seck says all the schools receiving the grant will share their curricula.
Which will provide some huge advantages for the state and really leverage the ability of our two-year colleges participating in this grant to really respond to workforce and industry needs.
Seck says the U.S. Department of Labor awarded about $460 million nationwide for this grant. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, federal forest administrators have shut down a stretch of U.S. Highway 12 in north central Idaho to trucks hauling big and wide loads. The closure order was issued today by the U.S. Forest Service for a section of highway that runs through the Locksaw Clearwater Wild and Scenic River Corridor. It comes days after a federal judge blocked a second shipment of giant oil field equipment planned for the winding roadway. Oregon hauler Omega Morgan had expected to begin its journey across Idaho today into Montana, then north to Canada. But the order may also apply to other so-called mega loads. The agency says the closure applies to any load that exceeds 16 feet in width, 150 feet in length, or takes more than 12 hours to travel through the 100-mile corridor.
A former Montana Army National Guard soldier charged with fleeing the country to avoid facing felony sex crime charges has been apprehended in Spain. Lewis and Clark County Attorney Leo Gallagher tells the Independent Record that 38-year-old Jeffrey Lane Wenzel was arrested last week. Wenzel was charged in June 2012 with a felony sex crime against a minor and 2 counts of sexual abuse of a child involving enticing the girl to send inappropriate photographs of herself via cell phone. Wenzel didn't show up for his trial in January. Prosecutors added a felony bail jumping charge, and on January 30th, federal authorities charged him with unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. At the time of his initial arrest, Wenzel was a sergeant first class with the Montana Army National Guard stationed in Butte.
The Missoula County attorney says charges have been filed against a 22-year-old man who was shot in the stomach during a home invasion. County attorney Fred Van Valkenburg tells KECI-TV that Dylan Torrey Franklin faces charges of felony burglary, criminal mischief, criminal trespass to vehicles, and disorderly conduct. Police say a 77-year-old man was awakened by the sound of breaking glass at about 2 a.m. Sunday and found someone entering his house. The man told police he warned the intruder that he had a gun and to leave. When the man didn't leave, the homeowner shot him. Van Valkenburg says the homeowner will not be charged. Under Montana law, people have the right to protect their homes using any means necessary. Franklin will appear in court when he is released from the hospital.
A Missoula man has pleaded guilty to shooting an East Missoula convenience store clerk during a robbery attempt last September. KECI-TV reports 23-year-old Christopher Lee Birch pleaded guilty today to attempted deliberate homicide and felony robbery. Birch was arrested last September and charged with going into an Ole's Country Store in East Missoula carrying a scoped rifle and shouting at the clerk, "Give me all the money." When the clerk ignored the request, he was shot and critically injured. The clerk lost a lung and his spleen due to the shooting. Birch does not have a plea agreement with prosecutors. He is scheduled to be sentenced in December by District Judge Ed McLean. The getaway driver, Preston Hanna, is serving a 20-year prison sentence for accountability to robbery.
State wildlife officials are trying to determine why more than 100 white-tailed deer have died along the Clark Fork River west of Missoula. Fish, Wildlife, and Park spokeswoman Vivica Krauser says the deaths started only recently.
Well, over the last few weeks, we've found over 100 dead deer in the kind of from the west of Missoula all the way to Frenchtown in that zone. And outwardly, they're not showing any symptoms or they're not looking like they have a disease, but that's most likely the reason is some sort of disease. So what we're doing is taking field samples, sending them into the laboratory in Bozeman, and right now we're just waiting on the results to see what may be the cause.
Krauser says some people have been seen perfectly healthy-looking deer simply fall down and die.
We do want to hear from folks who are finding these deer in this area west of Missoula. We want to hear the reports of where they are, and we'll follow up and take more samples. So in that sense, we're relying on the public for some help. If it is a disease, one thing that is a potential is that it's a disease called EHD, which is something that's transmitted by biting gnats. And it affects deer, but it doesn't affect humans. So in terms of human safety, we don't need to be concerned in that sense, but for deer, it is a concern and something we want to hear about.
If EHD, or epizootic hemorrhagic disease, is responsible for the deaths, there's good news. The season's first frost isn't far off, and that should kill the gnats that spread the disease. Meanwhile, Krauser says wildlife biologists will keep close tabs on the deer mortality.
As we try to determine the boundaries of the affected area and the full extent of the deaths of the deer involved, there are things we'll be considering as we move into hunting season, such as, is this an area where we need to make any sort of emergency adjustment to regulations or not? Right now, it's too early to tell. We need to know for sure what's causing it and the full extent. Where we sit right now, it's not too alarming, but if we do discover more and a wider spread, then we're going to need to pause and see where we're at before we head into hunting season.
Wildlife biologists have collected lung, spleen, and blood samples to try and determine why the deer died.
Yvette Ortega and Eric Green are UM biologists who found that spotted knapweed, the invasive weed familiar to most Montanans, is changing the way birds sing. Kendra McQuillan has the story.
The hated purple flower. In Montana, it's everywhere.
Just have to look around some of the prairie areas around us, Mount Sentinel and others, and it's pretty clear that spotted knapweed can be a really aggressive invader.
Eric Green's a professor of biology at the University of Montana. Green's studying what spotted knapweed does to native ecosystems.
Loss of grazing plants for deer and elk and cattle and whatnot, changing what sort of communities are present in knapweed-infested areas. It really does change a lot of things.
Spotted knapweed even changes what we hear.
Who would have thought that one species of plant can change how birds learn to sing?
Green's hunch grew out of the research of colleague Yvette Ortega. Ortega was studying how knapweed affects chipping sparrows, a common bird in Montana.
Knapweed invasion has a big impact on the native plant community. That change then translates to the insect communities.
Ortega says less abundance and diversity of native plants means less abundance and diversity of insects. Insects that chipping sparrows eat.
Birds that do well tend to return to the same spot year after year, whereas birds that do poorly tend to not return. So in knapweed invaded sites where the birds were generally doing less well, We have a lot of turnover from year to year, different birds every year.
And the birds coming and going from knapweed-infested areas tend to be young birds because they're the ones scouting for new habitat, which means that weedy habitats have younger bird populations than native habitats, where older birds tend to remain.
That's the level where most studies stop. They say, okay, this is what's going on with the bird populations. Eric Green had the idea, well, wow, you're seeing these big differences in bird populations. This might really have a big impact on song.
We know a fair bit about how birds learn to sing, and there's a lot of social influences. They pay attention to their elders and copy songs and all this sort of stuff.
With fewer older birds to serve as song teachers, Green wondered if songs would sound different in knapweed-invaded habitats. So Green, Ortega, and student Aubrey Benson recorded the songs of 159 male chipping sparrows from six different sites.
Each individual bird actually sings its own distinct song, very much like every person has its own fingerprint. So chipping sparrows in general sing a trill, but the trill, the actual notes, vary from bird to bird. Here's a clanky one. Now this one's a lot drier, kind of like an insect. What we're seeing is that the song diversity is essentially mirroring the plant and insect diversity. In the knapweed sites, where there's all this turnover, there aren't as many older birds to pass on the songs, so you end up in the end with fewer song types on the landscape.
All because of one plant.
The sort of take-home message of ecology is that it's really complex out there, and things can be connected in lots of really, really complicated ways that we're just beginning to untangle.
The next step, Ortega says, is using these findings to understand more about what's happening in ecosystems by simply listening to bird songs. In essence, letting the birds tell us what's going on. Their study will appear soon in the journal Ecology. You can also read it online at www.esajournals.org. Reporting for Science Source at the University of Montana, I'm Kendra McQuillan.
The first female ambassador to South Korea is retiring from the U.S. Foreign Service after 35 years. Part-time Montana resident Kathleen Stevens has served missions in Europe and Asia and received numerous awards, including the 2009 Presidential Meritorious Service Award. Stevens served as ambassador to South Korea from 2008 to 2011, returning to a country she first visited as a Peace Corps volunteer in the 1970s. In this feature interview, Stevens talks with News Director Sally Mock about her Korean experience and about the role of diplomacy in the 21st century.
I've spent about 11 years of my life in Korea, starting in the mid-70s when I went as a Peace Corps volunteer and spent 2 years there, and from that joined the U.S. Foreign Service, the U.S. Diplomatic Service. Went back again in the 80s at a time of huge political turmoil and change in Korea, and then circled back around, as life sometimes does, and was ambassador there from 2008 to 2011. So I had the great privilege of being, I think, not only a witness to some extraordinary history, but also a kind of a participant in some small ways as in Korea's own journey of economic and political development.
You speak fluent Korean.
Well, I studied Korean in the 1970s as a Peace Corps volunteer, and as the only non-Korean living in the small town where I lived then, I certainly use a lot of Korean. I studied more in the Foreign Service and dusted it off 20 years later before I went back as ambassador. I think it was good for my aging brain. And I think that, more than anything, helped me understand all the changes that Korea has experienced over the years, and also the continuity of the culture and the history. So
it's almost impossible, isn't it, to truly know a culture unless you know the language. It's such an insight into the culture.
I agree with that. I think that the process of studying the language itself is a process of learning that culture, because they are, as you suggest, so embedded in each other. So even if you don't get to the point of, you know, being able to do a full interview in that language or give a speech in that language or do certain things, I really think that without the effort to learn the language, you can't begin to penetrate a little bit of what that country is about.
Mm-hmm. How frustrating is it for you as someone who knows this country so well, Korea, to live in a country that knows so little about it?
Well, I mean, I would say this. I mean, as a foreign service officer, I've spent most of my career overseas working in other countries and representing the United States. And, at various times coming back, it was always a little hard to, as anyone who travels knows, to come back from, well, the Balkans at a time of great turmoil, or Northern Ireland, where people maybe fall a little bit more and find that people, have their own lives. They're busy. We're a big continental country. So the level of interest in these things varies a great deal. In terms of Korea, I guess I would say I've noted over the years, since my perspective now is several decades, that generally speaking, Americans know a lot more about Korea than they did some years ago. Now, some years ago, it might have been the Korean War, or maybe of a certain generation, they might remember a TV show called MASH or something like that. But now, I think with the Korean-American community, its success throughout the United States in business, in academia, in all walks of life, South Korea's own success as an economic power, as a source of culture like Psy and the famous Song of the Summer, or was it the spring? I've forgotten. So I think comparatively speaking, when you say Korea to Americans today, you get a more varied response and a little more interest, actually, than some years ago.
I want to talk a bit about North Korea. There were many, I think many in the diplomatic community, too, who had high hopes that Kim Jong-un would be more friendly with the West, that he would be different than his father. And that's not been the case. Were you surprised as well? Did you have that expectation? Or just
I guess after all these years, I mean, in my own career of mostly, hard and disappointing experience and trying to find a way to urge and push North Korea to a more constructive role in the world and a better life for its people, I try not to be surprised too often. But I think it was very disappointing. It's fair to say that in the early months. You know, this is a regime that has been in power now since the division of Korea and the establishment of North Korea and the end of the Korean War, and from grandfather to father to son, it has at every point I think taken the wrong choice for its people, for developing the kind of economy and society that makes sense in the world we live in. You see someone young in their 20s coming in, you hear that he had a little education or a little exposure overseas, you have to hope, well, maybe that would make things a little bit different. But North Korea's a hard problem that's been with us for quite a while, but we don't give up with it. I think we have to continue to try to work with this. That's what diplomacy is, and work with that's what life is. Work with the circumstances we're presented with, and I think what we've tried to do with the new leader of North Korea is to say in a very consistent way, the door is still open, as it's been for some time, to a different future for North Korea when it makes some choices, moving away from pursuing nuclear weapons and missiles that are very ill-spit, among other things, and focusing more on a more sustainable and stable life for its people and for the region.
How would you rate the danger of that region right now? And by that, I mean, we went through this period, I think, in the spring where there was a lot of threats coming out of mm-hmm. North Korea, and I know South Korean government was very concerned about it as well. Mm-hmm. It waxes and wanes. We seem to have these periods where these threats are made and then things settle down again, and it's hard to imagine when the threat truly is serious, I guess.
Well, it's something that we and our South Korean allies and others in the region, Japan and China and other, the other countries of the region have been dealing with really, in a sense, for 60 years, since it was an armistice, not a permanent peace treaty, but an armistice that ended the conflict of the Korean War. And it is, at best, a very, very imperfect peace. And there have been, as you suggest, times of increased tensions and somewhat decreased tensions. But it's never been a time when we can say, we've got it right now. No, we haven't. I think the strong security alliance that the United States has with South Korea, South Korea's own success, not only as an economy but as a democracy, China's a growing role in the region and the world, Japan's, all of those, and our ability to work together on these things are all things that have allowed us to continue to have a region that's enjoyed, with the exception of North Korea, you know, an exceptional blossoming. Now, look how life has changed for hundreds of millions of people in China over the last few decades. So there's a great success story in Northeast Asia, and indeed in East Asia as a whole. And I think the U.S., our open markets, our military presence, our alliance relationships have been a part of that success. But North Korea has remained the outlier, and it's something we need to continue to work on. So we can't assume that there's not going to be another uptick in tensions, but I think we look to some of our diplomatic as well as our military tools to try to ensure that that we respond appropriately and clearly along with the United Nations and send a clear message and do what's necessary to really try to maintain stability and peace that's so important to us as well as, of course, the region itself.
I have one final question for you, and this is a really big picture question, and it's about diplomacy as an art form and as a political reality. There's been a lot of discussion, especially in the recent atrocity in Syria, and how the U.S. should or should not have responded to that. Mm-hmm. And it appears that diplomacy has succeeded for now in avoiding military intervention there. It brought up the whole discussion of how worthwhile diplomacy is as opposed to waving the sword.
You know, I actually like something that Secretary Clinton said while she was in office, and this was kind of her watchword, and she said that American foreign policy needed to be based on a three-legged stool, you know, as we all know that three legs makes a pretty good basis, and they were what she called the three Ds of defense, diplomacy, and development. And you need to have all of these, you have all these legs of the stool kind of in place to have something viable. Obviously, we're a long way from seeing a satisfactory resolution of the situation in Syria in any way. But I think we have seen over the last few weeks, and I'm not involved in these myself as I've now left my my diplomatic career, but we've seen a very interesting discussion that's also involved the American people and many of our allies and other partners around the world who don't always see the same things the same way about how we can use these tools to get to an outcome that, yes, I mean, the goal has to be to avoid further loss of life, to avoid military force, except in the last possible instance, and to use all the tools in your toolkit. So I think that's been a rather illuminating discussion in many ways. We have to kind of wait and see, and not just wait and see, but work hard on diplomacy is what, and be ready with our defense elements as we see how the situation unfolds in Syria. You know, my own view is that I've heard a lot of this debate that the use of chemical weapons is something that the international community, not just the United States, but the international community needs to take very, very seriously. And I'm glad to see that attention being focused in the United Nations and elsewhere on that. I think that's been very important.
North Korea has a stash itself of chemical weapons.
This is an issue that resonates globally.
I have been speaking with Ambassador Kathleen Stevens. She was the first female ambassador to South Korea from 2008 to 2011 and has had a 35-year career in the Foreign Service and a very successful career in that. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until midnight tonight for elevations above 6,000 feet in the West Glacier region. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and some patchy fog. Expect lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies with some patchy fog and highs in the 60s. In central Montana, tonight it calls for mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and lows 35 to 40 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies in the morning with a slight chance of rain showers through the day and highs in the 60s. For southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with scattered rain and snow showers and lows in the 30s. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 55 to 65 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Abraham Kim.
Identifying a role model who personifies greatness and leadership and who inspires young people to reach their full potential is a challenge. Some may point to historical icons like Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., or Mother Teresa. Montanans, however, do not have to look too far. One deeply revered leader is Senator and Ambassador Mike Mansfield. Many fondly remember him for his quiet but decisive leadership of and tireless service in the U.S. Senate as its majority leader, and for his foreign policy acumen in the U.S. Congress and as U.S. Ambassador to Japan that helped navigate the country through some crucial periods of U.S.-Asia relations. Although he died more than 10 years ago, I believe his life and legacy is still relevant today, especially as a powerful inspiration for students across Montana. To see how, we need to look more closely at his early life before he entered politics and when he was a struggling young man chasing a dream. Despite his humble beginnings, his tremendous life achievements make him not only a role model to follow, but also a poignant example that life's hard knocks and setbacks do not have to be permanently crippling to one's future. Montanans who remember Senator Mansfield often overlook that he had a troubled youth. His mother died early. His father sent Mike and his sister to their uncle and aunt in Great Falls, Montana. He was a strong-willed child with a tendency to run away and was a mediocre student at best. Mike was an avid reader, but he did not like school. He eventually dropped out at the age of 14 and joined the Navy, then later the Army, and then the Marine Corps. His overseas assignments in the Marine Corps opened his eyes to China, Japan, and Southeast Asia and ignited a deep interest in Asian history, culture, and politics. Today, knowing his complete life's journey, we can look back now and celebrate the youthful adventurism during his early years that laid the groundwork for his future career in national politics. But back then, these were not clear signs of an emerging leader. Moreover, upon leaving the military, rather than going back to school to pursue his newfound passion, he saw his immediate future tied to copper mining in the mines of Butte. Fortunately for Mike, and of course Montana, key people in his life saw his true potential to pursue bigger dreams and did not give up on him. His then-fiancée Maureen encouraged him to finish school, enter college, and follow his dream to study Asian history. She later married this penniless student and sacrificed her own career and financial security to help him fulfill his dream. At the University of Montana, Mike was a non-traditional student, entering college nearly 10 years later than most of his peers. Despite this delay in his education, a few professors saw promise in this tall, gangly former miner. They provided academic and financial support to help him finish his educational training and start his teaching career at the University of Montana. These important life accomplishments, of course, became the backdrop and the springboard for his future successful political career. In short, today, although we celebrate Senator Mike Mansfield's life as an exemplary demonstration of how one man can make a difference in shaping Montana, the United States, and our world, it also highlights how a supportive school community that provides training and opportunities, caring mentors, and wise companions can build up a great leader. Furthermore, one's troubled background does not have to be a permanent setback to one's future and potential. Hard work, passion, and great teachers can open a world of possibilities for students. As the new director of the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center at the University of Montana, my goal is to retell the story of the late senator to a new generation and to challenge Montanan students to think globally and to reach their full potential. In the coming months, the center will bring national and international leaders to the university campus to talk about their work and share their personal journeys. In addition, we will develop and organize outreach programs, seminars, and research projects on Asia, ethics, and leadership. With each effort, we will involve students, teachers, and members of the broader Montanan community to connect this great state to the world. Our aim is to open the eyes of students and citizens to the challenges and possibilities in our world and to engage the hearts of many in Montana to take ownership of some of the world's problems as their own to dedicate their lives to solve. I am confident that in our midst, there are many more Mike Mansfield-like leaders to come. Although Senator Mansfield is no longer with us, I think this is the best way to continue paying tribute to this great man and the best way to pass on his story to a new generation.
Abraham Kim is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join myself tomorrow morning at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.